I'd like to welcome everyone to the Florence Weinberg Show. Frank McKay here. So much more importantly, Florence Byham Weinberg, Dr. Florence Byham Weinberg, is our host each and every week. And as we always tell you, the author of 15 books and the subject of a documentary. Frank McKay here. Much more importantly, Doc, how are you?
I'm doing okay. Thank you.
Well, you were talking a little bit off mic about a very controversial figure in our history, and that's J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI, and of course he's everything from controversies from everything from his own personal potential cross-dressing, which, you know, who knows what's true, what's not true, but we do know that he had dossiers on everyone. From the Kennedys to Martin Luther King, and he persecuted just about everyone that he felt had anything that could be threatening to him or to the quote unquote American way of life. But a very dangerous man, if you think about it.
Right. Yeah, you summed it up pretty well. I'm going to go into one particular aspect of it that's being investigated right now in the House of Representatives. So that's basically what I'm going to be talking about. Okay, so my main purpose today is to talk about this investigation that has begun in the House of Representatives by two Democrats. It has nothing to do with MAGA, of course, with MAGA efforts to impeach President Biden and Alejandro Mayorkas, U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security, but rather looks back 70 years to another right-wing effort to discredit American citizens working to shore up the civil rights of minorities in this country. This was a joint FBI-CIA effort, a program called COINTELPRO. The current and COINTELPRO stood for Co-Intelligence Program. The current investigation is seeking documents from the FBI and CIA, especially those pertaining to the surveillance and disruption of Hispanic or Latino activities who worked between 1956 and 1971 to improve the rights of Spanish-speaking citizens of the Southwest. But before I get to that, I would like to talk about what I know from my privileged Anglo point of view about the plight of Hispanics in this country. I've had personal experience of the prejudice and discrimination against Hispanics since my childhood. I was born to an Anglo family in Alamo Gordo, New Mexico, in 1933. My early contacts with Hispanics was in school, where they were my classmates. They were poor, sometimes coming to school barefoot and in torn and soiled clothing, but they came. Most of them spoke English with an accent and were therefore sneered at by my Anglo peers, who were dressed in clean new clothes, including white bobby socks and shoes. The attitude of the teachers left no doubt that the Hispanic kids, known as Mexicans, despite the fact that they were born in Alamogordo, that they were inferior to us whites. My own attitude was ambivalent. While I was aware of the class division in the schoolroom, I also saw that the poor kids could speak two languages and could talk smack about us to our faces and laugh. And we were none the wiser. I envied them and resolved to learn their code, that is, Spanish. I was told that a good introduction would be to approach one of those kids and say, ¿Quiere combate? I had no idea that I was saying, do you want to fight? The boy I approached doubled his fists and prepared to hit me. Whoa, I said, what I want is to talk to you. He calmed down and taught me a few Spanish phrases. I caught on to the cadence, tone, and pronunciation of Spanish, but not much else. I had to wait for college to properly study the language. Because in those days, in New Mexico and other places, even California, until high school in California, but later on in other places, languages were not taught. Anyway, my appointment as chair of the Modern Languages and Literatures Department at Trinity University in San Antonio in 1989 brought me back into my childhood environment after spending most of my life after World War II in the eastern half of the United States or in Canada. My experiences were mixed as before. When we moved from Rochester, New York to San Antonio, I spoke Spanish to the movers who unloaded the van at our new home. They replied to me in English, taking offense that I would think them so ignorant as to not know my language. Others were grateful that I did know Spanish, which by that time I had taught for 28 years. I soon learned the history of Hispanics in Texas, which was settled, like most of the southwest of the U.S., by descendants of the first European invaders of this part of the world, mostly from Spain, beginning with Cortes in 1519. Until the mid-19th century, 1946 to 48, during the Mexican-American War, the entire area still belonged to Mexico. Texas had struggled to become a republic independent from Mexico since 1813. The Texas Army of Independence had fought against the Mexican Royalist Army in that year, that's 1813, in the Battle of Medina. The Royalists, led by a savage and sadistic general, Joaquin Arredondo, slaughtered all members of the opposing army, leaving their bodies unburied on the battlefield. He then marched through all of Texas, killing all males old enough to hold a gun. He reduced the population to the point that Texas was considered too thinly populated to stand alone as a Mexican state. This led first to allowing Stephen Austin to enter Texas with 300 Anglo families to settle here in 1821, an immigration of Anglos that continued until the native population became outnumbered. After the Battle of the Alamo in 1836, Texas independence was declared and affirmed by the Battle of San Jacinto, when the Mexican general Santa Anna was defeated and his army driven out. Soon, Anglo dominance reached crisis proportions. One striking example was that the town of Victoria, Texas, drove out the entire Spanish-speaking population of the town, since they were all considered as terrorist traitors to the Anglo community. This attitude spread throughout Texas, which led to their relegation at best to the status of second-class citizens. This treatment of the native population continued into the 20th century, when the Texas Rangers drove out the owners of country ranches and estates in South Texas so that the Anglos could take over their land without paying very often, and most often, in fact. The King Ranch, which is famous in song and story, is an example of land seizure by whites. Seizure was often accompanied by at gunpoint, and resistors were simply shot in cold blood. Most Americans are unaware of this shameful episode in the history of the Texas Rangers, generally glorified, in fact, as white hat heroes by Hollywood and, of course, by the Anglos themselves. During the Mexican Revolution that began in 1910 as a revolt against the 30-year dictatorship of President Porfirio Diaz, continued against the Catholic Church hierarchy, then against priests and nuns generally, against upper-class Mexicans, and finally against anyone sympathizing with them. Excuse me. It was led by Pancho Villa and caused a large influx of refugees into San Antonio and other towns and cities in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. In San Antonio, these people settled on the west side of the city and built tiny houses called shotgun houses along the unpaved Guadalupe Street and a number of larger clapboard buildings for public meetings. Our Lady of Guadalupe Church was one of the first of many churches to be built. When the Jesuits took the pastorship of Our Lady of Guadalupe Church, the priest, Father Camilo Tranchese, S.J., invited and then guided Eleanor Roosevelt through the slum area near the church and one of the first housing projects, which is still in existence today, the Alasan Apache Courts, was begun. Father Tranchese's, as was the guiding spirit that later founded a number of activist groups. Thanks to the efforts of the Jesuits and of these activist groups that he founded or inspired, the status of Hispanics in this city has been greatly improved. The Jesuits and the groups, sponsored COPS, which means Communities Organized for Public Service, and Metro Alliance, which is the U.S. Representative Joaquin Castro's mother, Rosie Castro, along with other activists like Bill Maldonado, participated in the early years. They have worked to see that roads and sidewalks, street lighting, and flood drainage, adequate plumbing and electricity were constructed where dark, muddy streets and periodic flooding had earlier prevailed. I myself joined and worked in COPS shortly after joining the Congregation of Our Lady of Guadalupe Church back in the early years of this century. All of this is necessary background for a discussion of current efforts to establish what really happened to Hispanic activists in the fight for civil rights back in the Vietnam War era. We're going back to an era when Black freedom activists were beaten nearly to death on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, when a Black Baptist church was bombed by the KKK, killing four little girls, when Governor George Wallace stood in the schoolhouse door proclaiming segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever.
Wow.
We're going back to when Hispanic activists were treated in similar ways. The lead editorial in Tuesday's San Antonio Express News concerned an unpleasant bit of our history that should be of interest to the nation as a whole. The opening paragraph of the editorial reads, and I quote, "Among civil rights activists, anti-war protesters, dissidents, and citizens wary of the U.S. government's surveillance and slandering of Americans, there is perhaps no acronym more despised than COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI, which ran from 1956 to 1971, unquote, the year before J. Edgar Hoover's death. The investigation into the workings of COINTELPRO is sponsored by a local shining star by the name of Joaquin Castro. His partner in the investigation is Jimmy Gomez of California. Both are Democrats currently serving in our U.S. House of Representatives. Gomez served in the California State Assembly and took an M.A. from Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Joaquin Castro was born in San Antonio, son of community activist Rosie Castro. His identical twin brother, Julian Castro, was mayor of San Antonio and chief of housing and urban development under President Barack Obama. Joaquin served in the Texas State Legislature and is now in his sixth term in the U.S. House of Representatives. He serves on the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Select Committee on Intelligence. COINTELPRO was created to undermine the Communist Party, USA, but it quickly began to discredit and disrupt individuals and organizations thought by Hoover to be subversive and a threat to the country. Although the Ku Klux Klan was among the groups monitored and infiltrated, which led to important arrests and revelations, it just as quickly targeted groups protesting injustices, racism, and second-class citizenship, groups that were fighting to ensure liberty for all Americans. These groups included the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Black Panthers, Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, the American Indian Movement, and the Feminist Movement. However, Hoover especially hated Martin Luther King Jr. and took extra measures to undercut his leadership. COINTELPRO constantly violated the civil rights of individuals and organizations until in 1971, its existence was discovered. Hoover reluctantly halted its operations, and he died in his sleep a year after it after it ended. Investigations by Congress and declassification of documents have since uncovered some of the abuses Hoover inflicted on civil rights leaders and organizations. However, just last week, Joaquin Castro and Jimmy Gomez, both now members of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, reminded us of how much we are still in the dark about COINTELPRO, especially as it applies to its persecution and harassment of Hispanic civil rights leaders. They have written to CIA Director William Burns and FBI Director Christopher Wray, requesting that they release all documents on the surveillance of the Latino civil rights movement. I now quote that letter. As you know well, your agency's history of surveillance and disruption of groups opposing the Vietnam War and fighting for racial justice for African Americans is well known. FBI's COINTELPRO and CIA's CHAOS, that's C-H-A-O-S, and I don't know what it stands for, have both been described extensively in declassified released documents. Media reporting and certain disclosures from the FBI indicate that surveillance activities were conducted on the Latino civil rights movement, particularly during the 60s and 70s. The historical record on these activities that is available to the public, however, is much less robust, and perhaps even more importantly, the historical record is not clear about whether the FBI or CIA engaged in surveillance of the First Amendment-protected activities of the Latino civil rights movement, which would itself be deeply concerning, or whether it progressed beyond that to affirmative attempts to sabotage or disrupt the movement, as the FBI did with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Unquote. The two legislators are correct to ask for the release of documents. Much has been written, including several books, about the FBI's harassment of black civil rights organizations and anti-war groups, especially its stalking of King. But there is still a lot we don't know about the harassment, disruption, and surveillance of Latino civil rights activists. At a meeting last week, Burns and Ray did promise Castro their cooperation. They said they would look into the documents. It is urgent that they do so for the, and here I'm quoting a phrase out of the editorial, for the transparency and a full accounting of history, unquote. But also to remember the fierce struggle of those activists, Joaquin's mother, Rosie Castro, among them, and also Bill Maldonado, the grandfather of one of my close friends. Those people fought valiantly against suspicion and surveillance. The presence of the Castro brothers at the very top of our governmental structure proves the success and high status of some American Hispanics. Although redress for American Hispanics in general is still partial. The groundless effort by MAGA to impeach Alejandro Mayorkas, United States Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, proves that we still have a long way to go, even at the highest level. And that is my report on matters concerning our Hispanic population here in San Antonio and in the Southwest in general.
Wow. You know, one, and I know it's this is a little trivial, but one thing that stood out in the beginning of this is, you know, the individual that was falsely told a term which meant you want to fight to a Hispanic kid. That little girl grew up to teach Spanish for 28 years, little did they know it, the people who taught you that first terrible phrase, that was the first lesson you had in a very long life of teaching Spanish. So I just thought that was a funny little notation there, you know.
Yes, right. Yeah. Yes, well, of course, it was meant to get me in trouble.
Yeah.
And it was one of the whites who knew that phrase and taught it to me as a proper introduction.
Yeah, you know, well, go ahead. Yeah, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I'm amazed that as far as we've come as a society, it's like we're back to square one in some sense, right? You know, where we thought we got by, you know, you mentioned about Governor Wallace, right?
Yes.
Segregation now, segregation, whatever. There are still people who obviously have these same prejudices, and it's shifted.
Absolutely.
From black to Hispanic, you know, and trust me, there's still prejudice against people of color, no matter what color they are, as long as it's not white.
That's right. The Asians come in for that too.
Right. Just what a, you know, what a world we live in where, you know, I mean, how many years ago is that?
In my case, it's about 72 years ago when the incident that we just talked about happened.
Yeah.
I was just a kid in the fifth grade, in fact.
More than 72 years ago, right? You're 90. You're 90, right? So the thing is, maybe 78 years ago, right?
It's more 80, yeah, some 80 years ago.
Yeah.
Yes, it's much more than 72.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And yet
amazing.
I remember everything about it. I can stage the scene, make a script, a movie out of it, a video.
Yeah.
From my memory. Yeah.
And
it's incredible.
Yeah, and the thing is, it wasn't really your first lesson in prejudice either. You got that when you pulled into town, right? You pulled into town, and it said, you know, those non-whites, don't let the sun shine on you, right? Was that before or after?
That was after. Oh. I was by that time I was 12, and yeah. We had moved to the Ozarks.
Yeah.
From the first was New Mexico, so that was prejudice against Hispanics, and then we moved to Arkansas, and I hardly knew anything about blacks. I hadn't seen more than two or three of them, and there it was. The sign said, "Don't let the sun set on you here."
Wow.
Black man, don't let the sun set on you here.
Jeez.
And indeed, there were no blacks in that whole area. It was lily white all over. Inbred and ignorant and resistant to learning and so on. I mean, those people back in the Ozarks in those days, which was 1940s, were really behind the times, and as I say, inbred, so that they had difficulty with intellectual endeavors.
Yeah, inbred. You know, usually when people say inbred now, they're mocking, you know, in a an over exaggerated term. But when you say inbred, then you're literally saying that their parents were too closely related.
Exactly.
Yeah. Amazing. Did you, you know, I know this is off topic, but did you experience any visual effects of the inbred people? I mean, did they seem deformed physically?
No, it didn't go that far, but it affected their mental capacities. My mother taught elementary school off and on for years. And in New Mexico, she had Hispanic kids who were very bright and learned to read right away, learned English along with learning to read. She was teaching on the Texas-New Mexico border in a little place called Newman, which doesn't get or hardly exists anymore because the superhighway that Texas built bypasses it. But anyway, the Hispanic kids were able to learn to read despite the difficulty with language. And then later on, after I was born and I was 4 years old, we went to a very, very distant from any civilization, a place called Cienega, which was 110 miles from the nearest settlement, and taught those kids. And they actually were inbred too, but it didn't affect their intellects. They learned to read and everything else very rapidly. They were really smart kids. They were almost all of them was Lewis. Their last name was Lewis, and it was an extended family that had moved over a couple of generations earlier from Wales.
Very interesting.
And Yeah. This too is matter for a film.
Yeah.
And they had made their living by, there were, Cienega was right on the New Mexico-Texas border also, and they had made their living by riding on their half-Arabian, half-thoroughbred horses across the border, rounding up Texas cattle and horses, and driving them back into New Mexico. And the Texas Rangers, who pursued them on regular horses, they couldn't keep up with them. And so they got away with stealing cattle and horses from and sheep from Texas, and lived off that. And if they happened to confront anybody, since there was no law down there except their own, they would simply shoot them and drop their corpses into sinkholes, because Cienega was undermined, I guess you'd say, by an extension of the Carlsbad Caverns. At least that's our theory, that these caverns go under the Guadalupe Mountains and continue under the valley on the other side, on the west side of the Guadalupe Mountains. So anyway, they got rid of the corpses, and They were even tried for murder and got off because there was no body. They couldn't find a dead body.
No body, no murder.
That's right.
You know,
that was the way.
The reason I brought up the inbred was, you know, not out of morbid curiosity, but the irony, especially with the inbred people who had no capacity to form intellectual thoughts, or strong intellectual thoughts. The idea that they would be superior, they would have a feeling of superiority over these Hispanic people, knowing, or maybe they don't know, that they're inbred and that they would, you know, not only physically, mentally, and socially, people that are considered, not considered, but people that are in fact inbred, would be so low on the totem pole that the Hispanics in that day, a generation from now, those Hispanic people are going to be more assimilated, and then the people that were inbred, they probably would get weaker and weaker generation to generation. But anyway, I know people don't think like that, but to me, you know, the gall of the people that are inbred to look down upon Hispanics or blacks or anybody for ethnicity.
Who can outthink them? Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was to Cienega altogether, in World War II, the American Army took it over as a bombing range and drove them out. Actually, they paid them what the government thought that their land was worth, and then started bombing. And if they were still there, tough. And one of them did stay with a herd of cattle until an unexploded bomb lodged itself under his porch. And he figured he'd better get out of there because the next one would probably explode. And so he too left. And I tried to get back down there quite a few years ago, but with a regular car. And, of course, nobody had been in there. The whole place is fenced off with warning signs dating from World War II because there is unexploded ordnance in there. So I was unable to get back to a place where I had spent my years from 4 to 8. And it made a deep impression, I might say, scar on my development as my psychological development, you might say, because instead of persecuting my parents as teachers, they persecuted their child, namely me. And so I had a terrible inferiority complex when I left Cienega, which I have worked all my life to get over. Yeah. So what happens to you during those particular years is extremely crucial.
And just think about it. The people that were looking down upon you, I doubt very much they've written 15 books, some of them textbooks, right? 15 books, been a subject of a documentary and hosting their own shows and seeing the world that you've seen teaching the different subjects, the various universities and colleges that you did. You know, it's amazing how prejudice is blind. Not only is it mean and angry and just disgraceful, but it's also hypocritical is the word, or so misdirected. Your confidence was brought down by people who couldn't clean dirt off the bottom of your shoes, and the same with these poor Hispanic people that are going through it now. I mean, anybody that is that short-sighted, anybody that is that that mean, angry, and have the lack of intelligence to be prejudiced against somebody because of the color of their skin, Certainly shouldn't be able to bring somebody's confidence down, but they do, and it's just part of it's part of life, and
it's the MAGA crowd. It's our Republican candidate for president of the United States. He's precisely like that.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you. Certain people will make an argument that that's how people bring or try to elevate themselves by bringing down others and saying, saying they're rapist or they're drug dealers or they're whatever. And you brought up this point before, and I say it to everybody, the drug dealers aren't crossing the border illegally there. The drug dealers have enough money to fly in, they could fly in and get in through. They could buy off different people and get in some different ways. The drug dealers are too sophisticated to be crawling across razor wire. These people that are coming in aren't your drug dealers. They're not your, I'm sure some rapists and murderers sneak in there, but the people that are getting cut up by, and I know it's a different subject and it's a different show, but the people that are getting cut up by Greg Abbott's razor wire, they're most likely people that are just dying to be part of us, dying to be part of, literally dying in some cases, dying for their families to grow up American and to live the American dream. And
that is absolutely true. Yes, it's mothers and children, fathers and their children, who are looking for refuge and for help and for making a decent living for a change, undisturbed. Those are the people who, as you say, are wading across and sometimes drowning in the Rio Grande, and who are getting cut up in the razor wire, which should not be there at all. And neither should Operation Lone Star, which is only a hindrance to what the federal government is trying to do.
Yeah. And you can make an argument, and I think it'd be a very accurate argument, that those people that are risking life and death, life and limb, are going to be the authors of the great American dream story, much more than some inbred, much more than some person screaming about how inferior these people are coming out over here, taking their jobs and take. I got news for you. If somebody swimming across the Rio Grande is taking your job or has a chance of taking your job, you don't have a very good job. And you might want to concentrate a little more on your education or self-improvement rather than putting down these people. But there is not, you can make an argument that there is nothing more American than to put your life on the line to become an American. And
that's right.
And these individuals are in the very beginning of writing an amazing story that hopefully their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren will be able to tell and tell proudly about how they became Americans. And if that is not the case, if we're not proud and we don't elevate the people that went on homemade rafts to come from Cuba, let's say, to Miami and to get into America, if we're not elevating those people in generations from now, then we don't have much of a country left. That's the case, these are the people that we should be honoring. And people like your husband, he got here and he has a story, even posthumously, he has a heroic story. And Kurt Weinberg is the American dream in essence, and you know, these people coming a different route, coming from a different part of the world, nevertheless, these people to me are you know, heroic figures.
Yes, absolutely. And Kurt fought Hitler in the French Foreign Legion until the fall of France. Then he was interned in a concentration camp. He got out of that to come with great difficulty to the United States. Then he turned right around and volunteered to go back and fight Hitler in the American army, put his life on the line again. And of course he was. In those days, when you did that for the American army, for the American cause, and for the cause of liberty, you got American citizenship right away. So a lot of those refugees who did that, Kurt and his best friend Ralph Friedman did that, and that's, as you say, these are heroes. So many of these people who put their lives on the line, as you say, trying to come here, will be among the stars of the future, like Joaquin and Julian Castro, because yeah, their grandmother is one who came across fleeing from the Mexican Revolution, fleeing from Pancho Villa. And the grandmother worked as a cleaning lady and daily laborer. And her daughter, Rosie, was the activist that I have spoken of several times. And so this is how it evolves.
That's the American dream right there. What you just described is the American dream.
Right. So grandmother emptying chamber pots.
Yeah.
Mother, an activist for Hispanic civil liberties and civil rights. And the sons, the two sons, the twins, both of them in the highest levels of American government. And there you go. That is a perfect example.
Well, listen, great job as always. Thought-provoking and heart-wrenching, too. You know, just the whole idea of prejudice. It's and how far we've come, but really how far we haven't come in some aspects. And you know, look, J. Edgar Hoover, you know, like his anyway, we could talk forever about him. Great job, Doc. Wonderful job on this. And always you never cease to amaze me at coming up with something each and every week that's just thought-provoking in so many different subjects. So thank you for that. And to everyone out there listening, thank you for listening. And we know you have a lot of options, and we thank you for using this show as one of those options. We know time is valuable, and God bless all he is. Doc, thank you, and to all of you, thank you.
Thank you for sponsoring me, Frank. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, you're the best. Frank McKay signing off for Dr. Florence Byham Weinberg, and we will talk to you all next time on The Florence Weinberg Show.